You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon. I'm Kevin Casasamora, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy and the Acting Director of the Latin American Initiative at Brookings. Thank you all for being here today. For me, today is a joyous occasion. First of all, a dear colleague at the Latin America Initiative, Dr. Diana Negroponte, is unveiling a new book for which I, warm way, I want to congratulate her. But it so happens that the book that she's launching today deals with a set of issues that, as a Central American, matter to me a lot. Over the past year or so, the Latin American Initiative has been hosting many events on the challenges of Central America. Inevitably, most of those discussions deal with the bad news coming out of the region, from the very troubling security situation to the fact that the region, to this day, continues to expel young people by the hundreds of thousands. It is rare that an event comes along that allows us to take a more balanced look at Central America. For all the immense problems that the region faces today, when we talk about challenges in Central America, we must never forget where we come from. Little more than two decades ago, civil wars were raging in three countries in the region, and a narco-dictator was ruling another one. What the current problems are forcing us to realize is simply that ending wars is in some ways the easy part. It required the will and the courage to sit down and negotiate a settlement. Yet, building more equitable societies, solid democratic institutions, and prosperous economies requires those same attributes over a very, very long period of time. All the same, I do think that Central Americans are entitled to take pride in the fact that leaving behind the wars was very much an achievement of the Central Americans alone. Whatever the problems the region must deal with now, considering where we come from, the glass in Central America is half full, not half empty. Diana's wonderful and insightful book on El Salvador reminds us that peace negotiation processes are inherently messy affairs, where the ethically desirable is nearly always trumped by the politically expedient, where immense political courage coexists side by side with petty jealousies and machinations, where the urgent task of leaving behind a bloody past does not necessarily mean doing all that is necessary to gain a future. Above all, it reminds us that peace and development never arrive at a stroke of a pen, that they are the work of entire generations. The Central American Peace Accords threw a lifeline to the region. Now it's up to us Central Americans of today to make sure that that lifeline is not drowned in a sea of sorrows. And I must confess that Diana's book is the kind of work that, as a Central American, particularly one like me that didn't leave the region out of necessity but out of wanderlust, that makes you want to go back to try and realize the bright promise that the region had two decades ago. Thank you, Diana, for making this conversation possible. Unfortunately, I can't join you in the discussion, but we have here wonderful speakers that will more than make up for my absence. We have, thus, the distinct pleasure of having among us His Excellency Francisco Axul, Ambassador of the Republic of El Salvador to the United States and a good friend of Brookings. We are also happy to have here my good friend Cindy Arnson, the Director of the Latin American Program at the Wilson Center, and an expert of many years on Central American issues, and that includes writing and publishing two wonderful books on the region. You can read on the program the many accomplishments and experiences that they both bring to this discussion. They are indeed uniquely qualified to join Diana in this conversation about the past, the present, and the future of El Salvador. Thank you both for joining us here. And thank you all once again for helping us continue this conversation on Central America. Diana, over to you.
Good afternoon. I want to thank my fellow panelists for both reading the book and then being willing to come and enter into a critical discussion with me on the question of whether the peace that was achieved 20 years ago, last weekend, is a real peace. It's unusual for someone who launches a book to have a PowerPoint presentation, but I went into Google Pics, and I found such good photographs that I decided I would have a PowerPoint presentation this afternoon. A bare outline. Ambassador Maestro, you are most welcome, and there are seats waiting for you right up in the front, so walk strongly forward. The reason I put up this photograph is to show the mountainous or hilly character of El Salvador, as well as its neighbors. Because although this war was centralized in El Salvador, the capacity to have rest and recreation across the border, to be resupplied across the border, remained a permanent feature in the 12 years of that war. This is one of my Google pics, but so is this one. 12 years, 70,000 people dead, 500,000 displaced, and $2 billion worth of destruction. A small country the size of Massachusetts decimated by a civil war among its fellow citizens, many of whom are sitting in this room today, some who fought with the armed forces, and some who fought or were closely aligned with the FMLN. They are all committed Salvadorans, and as I did this work and my passion in doing the research on it, I have emerged with a huge admiration for the strength, the intelligence, and the bravery of Salvadorans. And if you ask the question, why is a British woman studying El Salvador, I have a reason in this room for telling you. My husband and I are the proud parents of 5 Central American children, one of whom is with us this afternoon. And I needed to know their heritage. So when I went up to Georgetown to get a PhD, I knew immediately which area I should study because I wanted to be able to understand their background. The young lady with us, Alejandra, was too young to join the FMLN. There are many young women who fought, but those young women did not participate in the peace. And that, I believe, is an issue which we should confront, not only with the Salvadoran situation, but with others too. How can you ensure that half your population has a commitment to implementing peace, to consolidating the gains which came from it? Joaquin Villalobos, who was one of the leaders, one of the comandantes of the guerrilla force known as the FMLN. I was with him 2 months ago in Toronto because he still doesn't have a passport to the United States. It seems very strange that a man who was so honest in those peace talks is not recognized today, but his impact and his ability to influence the conflicts in Mexico and in Colombia goes beyond the Salvadorian border. Another leader of the FMLN, Shafiq Handal, who subsequently became the leader of his party and died last year, Ambassador Altru, 22 years ago. But for the government, there was a very brave man. Alfredo Cristiani was married to the daughter of one of the wealthiest men in El Salvador. He could have become what was known as an oligarch. He could have protected his land, his pharmaceutical industries, and those of his wife. Instead of which, he joined with other businessmen of more moderate opinion and determined to end the war. Now, for Christiani and his colleagues, ending the war did not mean negotiating with the FMLN. There would be no negotiation because that meant concessions. And how do you concede to men and women who have kidnapped, murdered your family members? So the word negotiation was not to be used, but rather dialogue was to be used. Tendentious efforts until in November 1989, the FMLN made one last huge effort at a military engagement. They entered San Salvador. They occupied it for 3 weeks. During the day, the armed forces had the predominance. And at night, when they went back to their barracks, the FMLN came out, and they were in control. But it was very clear that there was a stalemate. Neither side could win militarily. Therefore, in December 1988, the FMLN reached out. 89. Will you please forgive my error here? Yes. I think. I'm talking about the offensive. 89. So I've got, thank goodness I've got experts up on here with me. The FMLN agreed to send a delegation to Montreal to meet with a UN bureaucrat known Alvaro de Soto. And yesterday I spent the afternoon with de Soto up in New York at the Council on Foreign Relations, he recalling the difficulties of making peace in El Salvador. He was committed to a UN role in bringing about a peace in this country. But around him were the officials of the United Nations who said, my dear fellow, you are crazy. If the United Nations gets involved in Central America, the U.S. government will pull the rug from under our feet. They, the U.S. government, consider that Latin America is their sphere of influence and there is no role for us. But something else had changed. The Berlin Wall had fallen. General Secretary Gorbachev had given his big speech to the UN General Assembly on December 8th, in which he said that the Soviet Union would no longer support wars of revolutionary nationalism. And that sent a message to the FMLN that although they did not receive funds directly from the Soviet Union, dependence on Nicaraguan support would become tendentious, weak, and that they therefore would have to rely on their own resources. That same month, a battalion, whose pronunciation I'm going to ask the ambassador to give me, went into the University of Central America, forced the six Jesuits out of their bed, made them lie down in the grass in front of their seminary, and shot them in the back of their head. Then they went back into the living quarters of the Jesuits. They shot the housekeeper in her bedroom and her 16-year-old daughter. What they did not count upon was that the sister of the housekeeper watched all of this from a nearby window. She subsequently went out to Miami and told her story. But the stalemate, combined with this ghastly attack on the Jesuits, galvanized the world. This was a horror which could not be accepted. Joe Moakley, very committed to the Catholic vote in Massachusetts, called upon for an investigation, and then the change begins. a willingness to find an alternative. And this man, the Peruvian UN Secretary General, was persuaded by Alvaro de Soto that there could be a role for the UN so long as the US agreed. This was not to be a ceasefire and then talk. This was to be talk and fight. Because the only leverage which the FMLN had was their capacity to return to the fight. And while for the United States government, and Ambassador Meister will remember this well, the ability of the FMLN to continue bombing at the same time as talking was wrong, it was the only way forward. And this man, a Democrat, very close to the Democratic majority in the House, but also hired by Secretary of State Jim Baker to lead this effort for the U.S. government, was willing to cross the aisle, was willing to talk with both sides, and he believed that a peace could be reached. I'm not going to go through this list. You can read it. But it became key in the first year of negotiations, the first months, to reach an agenda of what was at stake and what might be achieved. I'm skipping through this. I had this for yesterday because Alvaro de Soto would meet at fancy hotels in Mexico because the Mexican government plays a key role in this, offering a site both for the FMLN offices but also for meetings. And they put the Radisson Hotel in Mexico City, which is the picture up here at the disposal. And here would come the different emissaries' representatives. And in April 1991, key negotiations, they spent 3 weeks in this hotel, for the most part negotiating around the edge of the swimming pool with tequila abundant. But they reached agreement. They reached agreement except on this issue. What does depuración of the armed forces mean? Purging or liquidating? They agreed. It meant purging. You had to get rid of the senior officer corps and you had to reduce the size. You had to get rid of the paramilitaries. You had to get rid of the hated Orden and the National Guard and the Treasury Police. And those became the central issues of the peace process, which 22 months later reached in Chapultepec a signing between President Cristiani and the FMLN. And then the hard work began, how to implement it. So the new United Nations was invited in to go around the country and to collect the stories of victimization, abuse, and human rights atrocities. And for the first time in its history, peasant families and working class men and women had an audience, an international audience, for the bestiality that they'd gone through. And both sides assumed that the other side would take the major blame, which is why President Cristiani agreed to participate in it, because he was sure that the FMLN would take half the blame. When the report came out, 80% of the blame was placed on the government forces, 20% on the FMLN. And then began the process of UN experts and troops from all over the world, Spain and Uruguay and others, coming to decommission weapons, to train a new police force, and to set about helping in the creation of new institutions. The Truth Commission members, one of whom includes those of you who know Ted Picone, who works here. He was a young investigator with the UN Truth Commission here. I look for a picture on Google Pics, but he hasn't yet made it. But the armed forces were angry because the UN Commission report had named them. And in addition, there had been a private, if not secret, Salvadorian Ad Hoc Commission, which had undertaken its own investigation. That report still remains secret. Its names, too. But Christiani was obliged to carry out the recommendation that the leadership of Salvador's armed forces would be removed. And I tell the story in the book of the chargé d'affaires having been informed of the recommendation of this ad hoc commission. And without consulting Washington, very dangerous for a diplomat, asked for a meeting with the high command. And he went in to the high command and he said to them, "You signed the peace agreement. You must carry it out." And he was met with dead silence. And he walked out. He went back to the embassy and he called the assistant secretary and he told him what he'd done. And the assistant secretary said, "What? You what?" That was a way to protect Christiani from the anger of these gentlemen in this picture, who believed that they had been sold in order to achieve a peace. But the truth is that peace could only come if they agreed to stand down. They had to resign. And General Ponce Enrile, who's also up at the center there, took another job and passed away, I believe, just about 7 or 8 months ago. Christiani had to be protected from those, the traditional power in Salvadorian society, and President H.W. Bush gave his full support to it. Decommissioning went on, and in 1995, ONUSAL, that is that little white van, finally left the country. By that time, they were not popular. They were seen as interfering. They were seen as an infringement on sovereignty. And their work was essentially done, and it was left to the Salvadorians. I'm now going to ask Ambassador Altschul to take this story from here on onwards. Thank you.
Well, first of all, let me thank Brookings, thank Diana, and congratulate her, not only for an extremely well-researched book, but also for an excellent presentation. I am sure this book will become a very important input for understanding and knowing what is the process that led to the peace agreements is and represents. But more than talking about specifics of the book and the story of the agreements, I would like to start where Diana ends in one of her conclusions, which says, "Formal democratic structures may exist in El Salvador, but the spirit of democracy has not yet taken hold." I think this is true, but partially true. In June last year, we had a very important crisis, political crisis in El Salvador. The Legislative Assembly, with the approval of the executive branch, tried to reduce the autonomy of the Supreme Court, particularly of the Constitutional Court of Justice. This obviously created a serious problem, something that perhaps in stronger democracies would have been seen as a normal aspect of life. For us, it was very traumatic. Fortunately, we were able to move in a positive way, and the issue was resolved. And the Supreme Court continues to have the autonomy that it had before this crisis. But the fact that we had this crisis I think is itself a positive sign. Before the peace accords, this crisis could not have happened. Why? Because the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judicial branch were basically controlled by the same people, the same political parties, etc. Because there were very weak civil society institutions that could respond as many of them did in this situation. Because the mass media were before totally subservient, let's say, to the political system. And in the case that this had happened, the most likely outcome would have been a military coup d'etat. So even this, although this crisis showed that we are in a process in which we still have institutions which are still weak, but it shows also that we have moved from where we were before. And I think this is something that is directly related to the peace accords. Just like Kevin said, when you look at the peace of 20 years after, the question, and this is a continuing debate among politicians and academics in El Salvador and I guess other parts, is whether the glass is half full or half empty. Of course, people who see that the glass is half empty look at the incredible and terrible indicators of citizen insecurity and violence, the maras, the organized crimes, and so forth. They point out to the still existing polarization of the country, and also to the fact that we continue to be a country with extremes, inequalities, and poverty. For them, obviously, the peace accords did not change fundamentally the economy or the politics of the social structure of the country. Although I acknowledge the limitations of the peace accords, one has to realize that their main purpose was to end the war and to reconcile Salvadorian society. But they also aimed at opening a space and conditions so that we could continue through a democratic process the issues that had not been solved by the peace accords. In that sense, I would like to point out to at least three important issues that I think were accomplished with the peace accords and that we can objectively see them 20 years afterwards. One is the demilitarization of Salvadoran society. Since 1932, we had been ruled basically by military dictatorships with different degrees of levels of repression, but basically since then ruled by the military. It was the military, the armed forces, which determined the life of the country. Now, after the peace accords, the military was given, and I would say has complied in an exemplary way, the role that it was given, which is only to look after for and protect the sovereignty of the national territory. The military, the armed forces right now, do not have no any role in citizen security, in determining what happens in the life of the country, or administering many of the ministries and institutions of the government as they did before. A second important element, I would say, is the democratization of Salvadoran society. Right now, we enjoy real pluralism, freedom of speech, freedom of political rights, which was, I would say, the most important reason why we had to go to an armed conflict. Poverty, economic injustice, of course, play a role in that, but they do not explain by themselves the fact that we had to resort to armed struggle. The reason was that for many years, people tried to achieve change through democratic means, and this was not allowed to. And at the end, the only resort left was to go to a military struggle. That situation has changed. And now, and the fact that after 20 years, there is a government in El Salvador led by which is a government in which the FMLN, the former guerrillas, are an important part of this government coalition, is a recognition or a clear example that this democratization process has been moving on. And the third element, I would say, has to do with the respect for human rights. El Salvador was known during those years as one of the worst violators of human rights in the world. Diana mentioned terrific figures about that. People were tortured, disappeared, and so forth. This is no longer happening in El Salvador. Now we're looking and we're suffering a different kind of violence, but it is not in any way a political violence or result of violence that is results from political difference. In that sense, this has been a clear improvement. We have now, for the first time, a human rights ombudsman, many other institutions that have to deal with human rights. And now with President Funes, we're starting a fundamental aspect that had not been done before, which is first recognizing and asking public forgiveness for the violations of human rights that were done by the state. And second, what President Funes announced just a couple of days ago in a small hamlet, El Mozote, where a terrible massacre took place, he announced the creation of a new secretariat to deal with the moral and material reparation to the victims of violations of human rights. So, in a way then, perhaps we could see that, and that's why I say it was partially true, democracy has not taken your hold yet, but that we are moving in that direction. And that's why I think, and I would put myself on the side of those who see that the glass is half full. Acknowledging this doesn't mean that we don't see that there's still a long way to go to fill up the glass and that we have enormous challenges behind us. And there I totally agree with the conclusions that Diana comes forth in her book. Poverty and inequality, fundamental challenge that still has to be solved. Many people question the accords, saying the accords did not address the economic situation, this economic system. This was done on purpose because the belief was that you cannot, by decree, or negotiate a political, an economic system. The idea was, let's level the field so that through a democratic process and through the different proposals that different political parties put forth, it is the Salvadorian people who decide by democratic elections which way they want to go in terms of a new economic model. So the fact that we still are facing enormous inequalities, economic and social exclusion, and injustice, should not be seen, I think, as putting blame on the accords. This is part of the process. We have been lagging in that, but we also have to recognize that something like that is not only, it's not the sole responsibility of the government. Even the previous government, so these governments, the government right now, or any future government that might come, this is a responsibility for all sectors of Salvadoran society. And there are fundamental issues that we still have to deal with, which are difficult but necessary. Just to mention one, the need for a new fiscal agreement, a new fiscal pact that would provide the necessary resources so that we can invest in social development for the country. Another huge challenge, of course, is the situation of insecurity, of violence. It has been said also that this is the result of the war. I think that is, again, it's only part of the truth. It is definitely a an important element, but that does not only explain the levels of violence that we are having today. This is a much more complex situation. It has to do with the breaking of the families because of migration. It has to do with the lack of economic opportunities for the young people. It has to do with the lack of, in a sense, of hopelessness, perhaps, for many of the young people. But it has to do fundamentally with the enormous power that the organized crime and the drug traffickers have. So regardless, this is a fundamental challenge that we have. And I think it has to be approached in a holistic way, in an integral way, not only looking at the combat of crime, but also looking at crime prevention, also looking at the regional level, and also understanding that, that the main issue of drug trafficking has to do with three components of the whole process: the production, the transit, and the consumption of the drugs. And to end, I would say that the third challenge that we're still facing is the continuing challenge to strengthen our democratic spaces and our democratic institutions. What we have to do is to continue to fill the glass. And I think that is in the process that we are. There are, we have now institutions that we didn't have. That's a plus. Some of these institutions are working okay. Some others are still very weak. We have to nurture them and provide them and strengthen them so that they can guarantee that this process that we're that was started 20 years ago, that we've been walking up till now, but that we can continue walking towards a full consolidation of democratic society, which at the end, I think, was what the peace accords fundamentally were looking at. Thank you.
Diana, thanks for your book, for this invitation. I'm reminded when I look at the detail and the level, the amount of research that went into your book, I'm reminded of something that a very dear friend told me when I was writing my first book, which is that it is like cutting the grass with a pair of scissors. And I think that sums it up, but it also sums up the level of attention to detail and fact and counterfact, and I really thank you and praise you for this enormous contribution to the understanding of El Salvador, but also to the understanding of peacemaking in general. So thank you. Thank you also, Ambassador Altschul, for that wonderful overview. I think what I'll do is probably agree with much of what has been said by the previous speakers, but perhaps put some more meat on the bones, and also perhaps end on a more pessimistic note, because I think that the challenges that Salvador is facing, particularly in the security arena, do have the potential for undermining the gains thus far. I also have to say that there are, in fact, many people in this room who were protagonists, in El Salvador and the United States during these terribly high-pitched battles domestically in the 1980s over how to respond to the guerrilla movement in El Salvador and what U.S. policy should be, the degree of emphasis or not on human rights, on military reform. And I think that after the Berlin Wall fell and the Cold War ended, it became possible to actually have a discussion. But I would propose that there's still probably many different histories and discourses about what took place in the 1980s that would provide fruitful material for ongoing exchange. One thing that I think comes out from Diana's book and also from a review of the peace accords over the last 20 years is that accords themselves are not panaceas. They are not things that can resolve all of the problems in society, ushering in some kind of new golden era of freedom and development. But rather, they constitute significant and truly unprecedented stages in a country's transition in multiple forms, from authoritarianism to democracy, from war to peace, and from militarization to demilitarization. And I think it's the complexity and the simultaneity of those transitions in El Salvador that has made the process so complicated. One conflict resolution specialist noted that peace accords provide, quote, a new set of opportunities that can be grasped or thrown away. The peace accords in El Salvador, and I agree with what's been said, resolved historic crises of political exclusion that had spawned decades of violence and war, and the settlement launched an unprecedented and significant process of institutional reform. And that being said, and this goes to what I think Diana gave me as my assignment, accords are judged not only by the degree of compliance or noncompliance with the letter of the accord, but also by the extent to which they address root causes of war and satisfy both short-term needs and long-term needs for demobilization, security, political participation, economic recovery, and an end to impunity and injustice. And I'm sorry to use that metaphor once again about the glass being half empty and half full, but I think there is really, there are certain things that are very positive and also things that are very troubling. On the positive side, as Francisco has mentioned, because political exclusion, direct military rule, fraudulent elections were key causes of the insurgency and of conflict, the post-conflict political opening constitutes a central element in the maintenance of peace. The peace accord marked a demilitarization of politics, an end formally to the left's political exclusion. Indeed, as we know, the FMLN, by going to a more centrist candidate, won the 2009 presidential elections, something that caused satisfaction with democracy in El Salvador, according to the public opinion surveys carried out by LAPOP, to jump some 10 points between 2008 and 2010. There was also a reform of the armed forces, as has been pointed out, the end of its dominance of the political life of the country. Ambassador Altshul Francisco has pointed out the improved respect for human rights, and anyone who remembers the horrific violations of the war years, the assassinations, mostly, I think, some by the FMLN, the majority by government security forces, death squads, massacres, torture. All of us certainly celebrate an end to those kinds of violations and the end to killing for political reasons. There have been enhanced press freedoms, freedom of speech. There are online resources that publish unbelievable investigative journalistic accounts, including a very dangerous topic such as organized crime. And then finally, there's been the holding of presidential, legislative, and municipal elections. Representation has improved at the local level, and it is truly a competitive electoral system. On a more sobering note, Salvadoran society remains polarized politically as well as economically stratified. It is characterized by wide gaps between the rich and the poor, between urban and rural populations, and between the area of greater San Salvador and the rest of the country. Emigration, which has been mentioned before, provides an economic and population safety valve. It contributes to the economy through massive remittances, but it also deprives El Salvador of professionals, members of the middle class, campesinos, who count among society's most talented entrepreneurs. I think it's worth noting that remittances from the 2.5 million, approximately 2.5 million Salvadorans living outside the country, about 90% of which live in this country, account for approximately 18 to 20% of the country's gross domestic product. The peace accords, in attention to socioeconomic issues, as has been pointed out, was rooted in the dynamic of the peace negotiations. I would argue rooted in the kind of military stalemate, the relative strength and possibilities of the negotiating parties left important root causes of the war unaddressed. Now, I would disagree with some of the critics of the peace accord. Critics have noticed the inclusionary aspects of the peace accord in political terms, which stand in stark contrast to the economic policies that were carried out at least for the first 17 or 18 years, and the asymmetry between the political and institutional framework of the accord, which was inclusionary, I think has been noted as contrasting with the exclusionary economic model in the post-accord era. But I think that there's it's difficult to sustain that when one looks at the figures. Poverty and inequality in El Salvador declined over a period over the period of Arena rule. The economic reforms and the structural adjustment along the lines prescribed by the Washington Consensus led to growth in per capita income in the 1990s and the early 2000s. Inflation dropped, and key social indicators such as access to education, literacy, and infant mortality improved. Until the rise in food and energy prices in 2008 hit El Salvador as it did the rest of basically all poor countries, the economy had grown at a faster rate than the average of the rest of Latin America. And exports rose, the ratio of debt service to exports remained low, and the expansion of the maquila sector was really notable. And yet the benefits of this growth were perceived as not well distributed, and that's, I think, what became salient in political terms. President Funes came to power at a time of unprecedented domestic and global challenges, some of them prompted by the financial meltdown in the United States. El Salvador was second only to Mexico as the nation hardest hit by the global economic downturn. According to the United Nations Development Program, the country lost about 30,000 formal sector jobs, remittances went down, and this was compounded by natural disasters to which El Salvador remains vulnerable. Paradoxically, or perhaps understandably, the degree of integration between the Salvadoran economy and the U.S. economy has become a vulnerability. As the U.S. economy goes down, so does El Salvador. And I'd like to finish on the issue of the surge in crime and violence. El Salvador's longstanding issues of impunity have facilitated the operation of criminal networks. Sometimes it is alleged with the direct participation of state officials. There are allegations that members of the judiciary, the financial sector, political parties have connections to criminal groups. And there is a danger that involving the military in what has Ambassador Altschul described as the surge in organized crime and drug trafficking violence, the danger is that involving the military in the fight against organized crime will lead to a process of penetration and corruption, as has been seen in Honduras and Guatemala. We all know that that El Salvador is one of the most violent countries in the world, along with Honduras and Venezuela. Those are the three, according to the UN, the most violent countries in the world. 68% of homicide victims are between the ages of 15 and 34. 9 out of 10 victims are male. Again, one of the highest rates of homicides of young men in the world. The rate is also increasing in terms of violence against young women. What does this all mean in terms of El Salvador's future? There was a very disturbing poll taken last year, if I'm not mistaken, that showed that in order to combat crime and violence, Salvadorans would accept an end to democracy and a return to authoritarian rule. And I think a central question, as El Salvador, along with other countries in Central America, become more sort of overrun with drug trafficking organizations, with links to the Andean region, to Mexico, the Caribbean, and up to the United States, whether El Salvador's nascent democratic institutions and all today weak institutionality will be able to counter the kind of corruption and violence that come with these structures. So I'm sorry to end, you know, on this negative note. But I think that there is real cause for concern, and particularly cause for concern with the ways that the networks of organized crime are using existing gangs and MARTAs and co-opting those structures and working at a local level to manage and co-opt and corrupt politicians. So on that sobering note, I will pass back to Diana.
The floor is now open to you. So I would ask you please to identify yourself, your name and your affiliation, and wait for a microphone to come because we are recording this, and then we will seek to answer your questions.
Sí, prefiero hacerla en español, if you don't mind, because I need the soundbite in Spanish. La pregunta es para el embajador. Yo soy María Peña de la agencia EFE. Quisiera que profundizara un poco en esa preocupación que han mencionado de involucrar al ejército en la lucha contra el crimen organizado. 20 años después de la firma de la paz, muchos salvadoreños no se sienten seguros. El año pasado hubo más de 4,000 víctimas de violencia y está esa preocupación de que no es un país seguro. Entonces, ¿cuál ha sido la paz en El Salvador? Si pudiera profundizar en esa preocupación que hay, el papel que pueda tener el ejército para combatir al crimen organizado y lo que dijo la señora Aronson del peligro de que pueda haber más impunidad y corrupción entre los líderes. Gracias.
¿Cómo no?
Would you be willing to answer in English?
Answer in English?
Because I'm not sure that the majority of our audience today.
Last year there were more than, I do need the soundbite in Spanish though. My question was that last year there were more than 4,000 homicide victims, violence is running high, and I wanted him to go a little bit further on her comments about the risk of involving the military in fighting the drug cartels and the gangs and, you know, just organized crime, the real risk that involving the military could, lead to corruption, lead to co-opting the civil society and all of that. I wanted him to go further in that, in those real concerns that Salvadoran society has.
If I may suggest, I would answer your question in English, and after we are over, I'll gladly give you the sound bites in Spanish. Well, first, I totally agree with Cindy in the fact that the biggest threat to our democratic process comes from drug trafficking and organized crime. It is not ideology, it's not a foreign country, it is precisely this issue because, one, they have an enormous capacity to corrupt all the resources that they have, and second, they need and they thrive of weak institutions because that's also the best way in which they can prosper and survive. So I agree this is perhaps the most important challenge that we have. In terms of the role of the military in this issue, first, I think that we have to understand that the approach has to be comprehensive. It is not only combating crime, it is preventing crime. It has to deal with prison systems, rehabilitation and reintegration. It has to do with stronger institutions. And particularly here, I would also agree that one of the things that we are lacking and I have to work a lot is in the issue of impunity. This has to do with strengthening the Fiscalía, which is the General Prosecutor's Office, the whole judicial system. This is something that I've been working as a country for 20 years, but there's a long, long way to go. Things apparently are starting to change. Just two days ago, one of the most notorious drug traffickers who had been had been under trial for the past 4 years and had been once again left free, was finally condemned to 80 years of prison. So, good sign, but that is definitely a big challenge. Now, what the military, the army, has been asked to do by the president
is to participate along and under the direction of the civilian, the PNC, the National Civilian Police, in specific areas of security. It is not that they are coming out and doing by themselves autonomously, deciding what they want to do. They have been given a specific responsibilities. One, to take control of the border to prevent precisely drug traffic and contraband, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Second, control of the prison system, not only of the prisons themselves, but of the security of the periphery, of the periphery of the prisons, because prisons have become one of the best places in which organized crime operated from. Most of the extortions that were being done in El Salvador were conducted by members, gang members who were in prison. And the role that the army has been assigned is a temporary basis. It goes for periods of 18 months, and it is the president who determines whether they will continue or not. I understand that because of the history and the tradition of armies in Latin America, and particularly regarding human rights and so forth, there might be a apprehension about this. But as far as today, there had been no accusations of violations of human rights or any improper act conducted by the military in these specific tasks.
Thank you, Ambassador. Let's open up to another question. Yes, Mr. Ranke and then Rafael.
Good afternoon. My name is Julio Rank from the National Endowment for Democracy. This very day, the Supreme Court was going to review the Spain's request to extradite about 20 army officials involved in the Jesuit killing. What is your view on the importance of the amnesty law and the whole peace agreement? Because it seems like every time an electoral event comes around, these things get thrown, and it seems like no real reconciliation can happen if the threat of the amnesty law being derogada is always imminent. What's your position on that?
Julio, let's see. Do you want to?
Sure.
Do you want me to?
I can respond to that. I mean, I think what has been the pattern over the last several decades, certainly in Latin America, is that when national systems are not capable of delivering justice in significant cases of human rights violations, there's a sense that that's where the international community has to play a role. The Spanish request is related to the fact that some of the murdered Jesuits had Spanish citizenship, and so it was considered a crime against Spanish nationals, and that's the basis for the extradition. And I think that the inability of the court system in El Salvador historically, but certainly in the period since the peace accords, again changing slowly and getting better bit by bit, but the inability to investigate and prosecute not only high profile cases but cases against common citizens has been a really important weakness, and I don't think we should be surprised that even though the initial pact, which was to have a truth commission that was going to name names but had no judicial power, we should not be surprised that over time that is challenged. I mean, that's been the history in Argentina, that's been the history in Chile, it's been the history in Uruguay. What's notable in the Salvadoran case, I think, is the lack of national debate over these issues. There was a lack of national debate when the Truth Commission issued its report. It was immediately repudiated by the government, by the armed forces. Some NGOs, were interested in, the Catholic Church was interested in a debate, but its recommendations went nowhere. And I think what's not terribly healthy is that the debate is forced on a society from abroad. But that is going to happen inevitably, when there is not a national capacity, to come to grips with these kinds of things. So I think the answer ultimately lies in strengthening, the judiciary in El Salvador to deal with these kinds of cases.
Thank you. Rafael, and then the gentleman over here.
Thank you very much. My name is Rafael Hernandez, and I represent Central America and El Salvador in the board of directors of the World Bank. I am a Salvadorian myself. Let me just, you know, give you my brief opinion, you know, as a Salvadorian. I think that I share with the speaker that as Salvadorians, I, you know, take a lot of pride to see what has, you know, taken hold over the last 20 years. However, at the same time, I recognize that we are a long way to go. But also, I will, you know, like to think that, you know, the glass, you know, is half full and not half empty. But I would like to, you know, to make my remarks to the point that Cynthia made at the very, you know, at the very end of her presentation. And that is sad, really, that after 20 years and after the small but important, you know, steps that have been made in, you know, building a country, you know, building institutions in El Salvador, where a lot of people, you know, that dedicated their life and they committed, you know, many years, they are beginning to see the fruits. And then all of a sudden, El Salvador and the whole region has felt victim, you know, to the drug traffickers and the organized crime. And let me tell you why I'm very sad and disappointed, because I've lived in this city almost 30 years, and I have attended many of the interesting presentations at, you know, Cynthia's center, and every time that this issue comes about, 99% of the blame is put, or that the solution is going to come for what the El Salvador does in terms of doing, you know, away with the corruption, with, you know, the impunity, and so on and so forth. I never have ever said, look, we have a problem of demand in this country. We are the one who are perpetrating that when we go to the parties and have a good time and they offer us, you know, that when we put our noses there, there is a host of cadavers that they have been left along the way. I have never heard any public, you know, discussion in this country recently where they have come and said, look, Salvadorians are not going to solve that. Central Americans are not going to solve. We have the problem. It is still cool, you know, to buy drugs. And, you know, the middle class and the upper middle class, the politicians, you know, Wall Street, they don't see it. And no one is telling them that they are responsible for what is happening. But more sadder to me is that institutions such as this one or such as yours or others, the researchers, they don't want to address this topic. They shied away from it. And let me tell you, we at the World Bank are given the fight as well. When we did the World Development Report, our, you know, the Spanish director allowed me to, you know, to. I was the only one who said, it doesn't matter how much we do in the country. We have a problem of public health in this country, of demand, and unless this is addressed in a serious way, don't blame the Salvadorians for it or the Central America. I'm not going to say that we are not responsible for a lot. We are. But my point is that we are looking only at one side of the equation. And as long as we look the other way, we're not going to achieve any progress. Thank you.
Well, thank you. We have here, our next questioner is over here.
Thank you, ma'am. My name is Carlos Mauricio. I am from El Salvador. I found the Stop Impunity Project. It's an organization made of Salvadorian torture survivors. I am one of them. I was captured by the Salvadorian Army. I was kidnapped by the Salvadorian Army in 1983. And I came to the United States after luckily I came alive from the National Police Headquarters, in which I was tortured for about 3 weeks. I was in San Salvador yesterday. I was in San Salvador when President Funes came to El Mozote to ask for forgiveness to the people of El Mozote, and I was there. I was very happy. I am also a human rights advocate now because of my situation as a torture survivor. I became a human rights advocate, and I am so happy that now President Funes finally is coming to say something about what happened in El Mozote and naming names, saying that the army did, what the army did, what the colonels did in El Salvador, telling that indeed in El Mozote village, more than 1,000 Salvadorians were killed by the special elite battalion trained in the United States. Atlacat battalion came to El Mozote and killed more than 1,000 unarmed peasants. 30% of the killed were children, average age 6 years old. So finally President Funes came to El Mozote, and I am so happy that he finally came and said that indeed the amnesty given to the military is illegal. The amnesty given to the military that say that they were not responsible for the killing. Finally, President Funes came last Monday and said that no, we should talk about it, but that we should not longer naming heroes those guys who came and killed the peasants in El Mozote. And I am so happy because I believe, and I'm going to ask the ambassador if now is a cane is a way of or is a way of saying that the policy of the Salvadorian government now is finally addressing those issues and finally stopping impunity. I am really concerned about that because I believe that it's finally the first time that the government is coming and saying something about impunity that has been granted to the Salvadorian military in El Salvador.
I think that since President Funes came, he started this process. As I said, has been said before, this is a process that has taken in Argentina, Chile, 20-something years. But we're starting to move in that direction. First, when President Funes asked for forgiveness publicly for all the crimes that had been committed by the state, he apologized and asked forgiveness for that. Second, when there was a total change in policy at the OAS Human Rights Commission, when for the first time the Salvadorian government accepted the responsibility of denunciations that had been put in front of the Inter-American Human Rights Commission. And third, I would say, is this step that you mentioned, in which he is saying we cannot longer continue to name those people in the military that have is known that committed gross violations of human rights and treat them as heroes. We need to redefine, restudy all the history. And I think that is an important point of departure. And the fourth element is what he also announced in that opportunity, that the government, the state, is going to begin exploring the ways by which the victims of human rights violations can receive moral and economic reparation. I think these are first steps. It is not everything, but I think, as we have been saying before in other areas, we are moving in that direction.
Cindy, you wanted to answer Raphael, and then Dr. Bouvier.
I wanted to make a brief comment because I share a lot of the frustration with, you know, about what you're saying, but I think it's probably an unfair characterization of certainly the think tanks and whatever around town that we don't recognize the importance of demand and the role of the United States and the proximity, you know, the proximity of Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean to the largest drug market in the world as being a central part of the problem. Where I think where we have been frustrated is that there's a complete lack of willingness for political reasons to consider real alternatives beyond, you know, the current policies that are focused on interdiction, on, you know, suppressing the level of suppressing production, breaking up trafficking networks, that there's not any consideration at the political level, certainly at the level of the national government, you know, of alternatives along the lines of the things that are being discussed and, frankly, were called for just yesterday by the new president of Guatemala, General Otto Perez Molina. So I think that's where there needs to be greater opening. But I think that there have been significant reductions in demand in this country that have been important. But again, the the level of the responsibility that the United States has for the problem in Central America, in Mexico, whatever, in Colombia, Peru, whatever, is enormous, and yet the effects, the principal effects, are born in the countries where drugs are, you know, originate or are trafficked, and then among poor populations in this country where the, you know, consuming populations are concentrated. So we need to do much more on this end. I couldn't agree more.
Ginny Bouvier from the U.S. Institute of Peace.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you all for your presentations and to congratulate Diana for a very important book, and Brookings also for hosting today's event. 20 years gives us a chance to look back and think about what we might learn from the experiences. And I'm wondering, first of all, Diana, if you could talk from some of your interviewing, if you could make any assessments about mistakes that were made or things that might have been done differently or better, or if it were to happen again, how things might be done in a second round. And that's linked to a question of what kinds of lessons you all might draw from the experience in El Salvador for other countries such as Colombia, which are still experiencing conflict and looking forward to some sort of peace process down the road. What lessons can we take from El Salvador?
Give you just two lessons which come to mind to it. And the first is that leaving the socioeconomic issues to the end of the negotiations and then just focusing on them as a means to reintegrate the armed forces and the FMLN fighting men and women into society left a major underlying cause unanswered. And it succeeded in providing a means for the fighting force to enter civilian life, but it did not provide a means for the majority of the country to participate actively in an economic worthwhile life. The second is the artificiality of deadlines. And that is one which the U.S. government contributed to. We were so impatient to reach an end to this war, to rid the U.S. government of this cauldron or quagmire of Central America, that the State Department kept on insisting, reach agreement, this date, that date, and the other. Well, this is rather like calling wolf, when it became very clear after the first and second time that the FMLN were not going to stop fighting, they were not going to decommission their weapons, they were not going to move to the concentration zones. The calling from Washington for deadlines became vacuous. So I think the second lesson I will focus on is that you have to have real deadlines, one of which was meeting the constitutional requirements of the Salvadoran government for changing the constitution, and the other was the fact that Pérez de Cuellar was to leave office on December 31st, 1991, and his successor, a distinguished gentleman from Egypt, knew nothing about this problem, cared very little for this hemisphere. That deadline forced both sides in the final hours to make the necessary concessions. The broader issue.
Two things, Ginny, because as you know, I mean, you've written a lot about this, and I've thought about it a lot as well. There are two lessons, particularly for Colombia, but I think broader. One of the things that the Salvadoran Accords or the negotiation process demonstrated is that intermediate accords can serve to build confidence and can be stepping stones on the path to a broader accord. That's what happened with the San Jose Accord over human rights, which brought in UN observers to observe the implementation and the verification of that accord and contributed to a decrease in the level of violence, which served to build confidence on both sides. And the way that I think plays in Colombia is that, you know, should there be an effort not to have sort of a ceasefire, you know, broad accord, you know, with the FARC and the ELN, but especially with the FARC over a human rights accord that would involve the release of kidnapped victims and the release of people held by the military. That would just go miles. Now, up until now, the FARC has not been willing to do that. But trying to identify some slice, some lesser slice of a global accord that the parties can negotiate, I think is important. The second piece of that is related, which is that making a ceasefire a precondition for talks is a very bad sort of precedent. As Diana indicated in the slides, fighting went on during the process of negotiation, which began in 1990, mm-hmm. Basically just after the offensive, but the first sort of formal talks in 1990 went on for about 2 years, which in the scheme of things, you know, and in retrospect is nothing, you know, compared to, say, the number of years that the Colombians have been trying to come to a comprehensive accord. But you cannot make the laying down of weapons or the declaration of a, not the laying down of weapons, but the declaration of a ceasefire a precondition for going into talks. And I think that this is a mistake that the Colombian government made specifically with the ELN at a time when the Mexican government was actively serving as an intermediary. And I think it's an ongoing problem. I can understand the sentiment, you know, behind, you know, if you're going to try to build public trust around a peace process, you can't have people placing bombs, you know, in military barracks and, you know, continuing to wreak havoc. I understand that mentality. But the Salvadoran negotiators understood the ceasefire as the product of a mediation, not a precondition. And I think that's one sort of lesson that stands out and that's been very important.
Ambassador.
Something perhaps for me is an important lesson, and perhaps it's too self-evident, but is that political settlement and negotiation is always the second best option. The only thing that makes possible a negotiation, at least in the case of El Salvador, and I think you mentioned to this, is with both sides understood that there was not a possibility of a military victory. Mm-hmm. Now, the additional comment to that is that even if a political settlement starts as a second best, it is the best end result.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for coming this afternoon, and I want to thank my fellow panelists for participating in this event. Anybody would like to buy a book, I'm ready to sign away, but thank you for coming.